Shabbat Shalom. So I happened to see this article last month in the New York Times entitled, "Is Your Religion Your Financial Destiny?" Anybody see that? I'll tell you about it. Citing a study of the Pew Forum on Religion and Political Life, the article asserts that the most affluent of the major religions is not only Judaism, Reform Judaism. 67% of Reform Jewish households made more than $75,000 a year, compared with 31% of the American population at large. Get that? Reform Jews made $75,000 a year at more than double the rate of the American population. 55% of Reform Jewish households, over half of Reform Jewish households, made over $100,000 a year. Conservative Jews made over $100,000 a year at a rate of only 43%. Ha! Take that. Who knew? You know, I'm aware that we are insistent in asking and expecting our community to give generously. I know that. And many, many members do, in fact, give very generously here. But had I known from among the entire American population that Reform Jews were the wealthiest, we would have asked you for more. We will. Now that we know the truth about you, we're going to ask you for more. It's like the day that a visitor came to the rabbi and said, "I work for the IRS. Is there a member of your congregation named David Tepper?" "Yes, I know him well," the rabbi responded. "Well," said the IRS agent, "Mr. Tepper claims that he donated $10,000 to the synagogue, and I'm here to make sure that he actually did." "I don't know if he did," said the rabbi, "but I can tell you one thing. He will." Reform Judaism is the largest of all Jewish movements. It is the wealthiest of all Jewish movements, of all Americans. Reform Jews even outperformed secular Americans when it came to income. But there are also other surveys out there about Reform Jews. And the other data show the following. Reform Jews are the least committed of all Jews, except for those who define themselves as secular. Reform Jews have the lowest level of Jewish literacy, except for those Jews who define themselves as secular. Reform Jews have visited Israel least of all Jews, except for those who define themselves as secular. Reform Jews attended synagogues and observed Jewish rituals least from among all Jews, except those who define themselves as secular. Reform Jews have the least chance of having Jewish grandchildren from among all the Jews, except for those who define themselves as secular. So we have this incredible confluence of need and capacity in the Reform movement. On the one hand, our congregants need us the most. Our congregants are most at risk. Our congregants are most deprived of Jewish content and of Jewish learning. Our congregants require the most talented and the most driven rabbis and the most talented and the most driven clergy and cantors and educators. Our congregants require the most creative and innovative synagogues and the most committed and the most generous volunteers of all of the Jewish world. But on the other hand, our congregants are also the most able. Our congregants are the most educated. Our congregants are the wealthiest. Our congregants have the most capacity to contribute to their own vitality and their own continuity. You understand this enormous dissonance? Reform Jews are the most educated of all of Americans. 59% of American Jews have a college or postgraduate education as compared to 27% of all Americans. And within that, Reform Jews lead the pack. Reform Jews are the most educated of all Americans, and yet Reform Jews are the least educated in Judaism. Any rabbi and any lay leadership and any Reform congregation worth its weight in salt will be measured by how effectively we are able to harness these unbelievable, unprecedented, unmatched capacities with these unbelievable, unprecedented, unmatched needs. That's why I'm always asking you for money. I'm not taking it to the Bahamas. I often think about families who have a child who is the last child that's having a bat mitzvah or a bar mitzvah in that family. And I often ask myself, will there be Jews in this family in 25 years? We had a beautiful, moving, uplifting ceremony this week for our graduating nursery school children and their families called Moving On. These children are leaving our nursery school after 3 years, and they're moving on. They were so excited and so clean. They were sparkling. Their parents were here. Their grandparents were here. All of our clergy and educators were here. Half of us were weeping, mostly for good reasons. It's bittersweet to leave one phase of life and move into another. But I looked at these beautiful children in whom we have invested so much love, so much care, so much attention, so much Jewish energy, and I asked myself, how many of these families are not only moving on, but moving out? That's it for the Jewish part of all this. Maybe they'll return in fourth grade for the bar mitzvah if they don't otherwise rent a hall or rent a rabbi for the occasion or simply do nothing at all. So many young families who join Reform congregations are on a condensed pediatric track. Begin at fourth grade, finish at seventh grade, the day after the bar mitzvah, and poof, you have received everything Jewish that you need in life. They never say that about seventh grade math. They never say that about seventh grade reading. They never say that about seventh grade comprehension. They never say to their kids, it's your choice. Drop out after seventh grade history. Leave if you want. But for some reason, they say that about Jewish history. For some reason, they say that about Jewish comprehension. Cannot sustain Jewish life without synagogues. Synagogues are where we create Jews and where we sustain Judaism. We do not make Jews in public schools. We do not make Jews in private schools. We do not make Jews in universities. We do not make Jews walking the streets of New York City. We do not make Jews gastronomically. We do not make Jews vicariously. We do not make Jews by swimming in a Jewish swimming pool. We do not make Jews through politics. We make Jews here. There will be practically no Jewish supporters of Israel, no Jewish donors, and no Jewish humanitarians if we do not create them first here in our synagogues. That's why I keep insisting that you give money. I don't take it to the Bahamas. Not discretionary money, because the need for this synagogue is not discretionary. Cold, hard-earned cash. You have it. Thanks to the Pew study, I know you have it. And if you don't have it, you shouldn't give. It's forbidden in Judaism to give what you cannot afford. But most of us have it. And I'm not only talking about our synagogue. Only a small fraction of Jewish philanthropy is invested in Jewish causes. According to a recent study that looked at 188 mega donations made by Jewish philanthropists, only 6% of these mega donations have been given to Jewish institutions. Can you even begin to imagine what we can do for Jewish life If this percentage is merely doubled or even tripled, say to 12% or 18%, can you imagine how much more we could invest in and shape our Jewish future? At this time of unbelievable dramatic need? We need to invest in her. It's expensive to raise this child from toddlerhood to Jewish adulthood. I understand why Jews give generously to every humanitarian, intellectual, and political cause under the sun. And I'm always exceedingly proud when I hear of large Jewish contributions to general causes. These are our values. For thousands of years, we have taught Jews to care about people, no matter who they are, and society at large. But what I do not understand, or rather cannot accept, is why we neglect the Jewish community, the very place that made us who we are and ensures our Jewish posterity. Why are we so generous to general concerns and so unconcerned about Jewish concerns? We need to develop a culture of Jewish philanthropy. It is a good and blessed thing that so many Jews are so generous with their time and their resources. Jews contribute so much to libraries, schools, universities, hospitals, theaters, museums, and other cultural and civic and humanitarian causes. If they can afford it, there is no limit to the amount that Jews should give to these causes. See, I said it. I said it clearly. I don't want to hear any telephone calls or emails saying, you know, the rabbi said don't give to general causes. I didn't say that. But I am saying, save money for Jewish institutions as well. And if you have it, save some serious money for Jewish institutions. Jews also need libraries. Jews also need Jewish schools. Jews also need synagogues. Jews also need to attend to their spiritual and emotional health. We need these institutions now more than ever because of the unique challenge that America poses to American Jewry. And from all of these Jews, Reform Jews need it the most. And Reform Jews have the most. If we don't take care of ourselves, no one will. Jewish life is our responsibility. Jewish survival is our responsibility. Jewish continuity is our responsibility. And we have the capacities. We have the education. We have the skills. And we have the financial resources in Reform synagogues. It's expensive to run Jewish schools and synagogues. Some time ago, my wife and I spent a weekend in Newport, Rhode Island. Anybody been to Newport? It's an amazing place. Attracted by the fierce desire of Newport to be free and to embrace religious pluralism, Jews began arriving in Newport by the 18th century. They built a famous synagogue. Been to that synagogue? It's called the Synagogue at Newport. Dedicated in 1763 and later visited by George Washington, who wrote an historic letter to the synagogue's leadership guaranteeing American liberty to the Jews. And of course, the community built a cemetery. The cemetery is at the top of the hill of the old historic center of Newport. It's a small cemetery, maybe a couple of acres, with a small number of graves. As I stood on the street, behind the locked gates of the cemetery, observing the gravestones and trying to read their inscriptions, I remembered that there was a famous poem written by Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, who stood at that very spot where I stood some 160 years ago. By the time that Longfellow composed his poem, the synagogue had closed and the cemetery was locked. He persuaded the groundskeeper to open the gates for him, and he spent some time alone there with his thoughts. And out of that came his poem. Longfellow believed that the Jewish nation had, in effect, succumbed to history. And the cemetery for him was symbolic of the Jewish people's demise. It pained him to think that after 3,000 years, Jews had reached the end of the historic line, symbolized by those Jewish leaders who were lying in the ground at his feet. So my wife and I, we Googled the poem on Blackberry, and as we stood there at the cemetery, precisely where Longfellow stood, we read the words composed by the great American poet. How strange it seems, these Hebrews in their graves, close by the street of this fair seaport town, silent beside the never silent waves at rest in all this moving up and down. Closed are the portals of their synagogue. No Psalms of David now the silence break. No rabbi reads the ancient Decalogue in the grand dialect that the prophet spake. But what once has been shall be no more. The groaning earth in travail and pain brings forth its races but does not restore, and the dead nations never rise again. We have risen and risen again, despite everything that history has thrown at us. We have reformed and reformed again. We've always found the resources to build communities, to build synagogues, and to restore Jewish life. May the Jewish people continue to live and to thrive now and forevermore. Amen.